This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Patricia Gray, author of a brand new book, Rupture, by Red Hen Press. And here she is.
This poem is called Blessing, and it's about a great, 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 great grandfather whose name I don't know, but whose story I've heard. Here's the way it goes. In from the field at noon, grandfather was obliged to put on a suit coat to come to grandmother's table. He'd sweat rivulets receiving the green beans and corn, iced tea, thy bounty, Lord. When he stood up, coat soiled, she'd turn away. A marrow of demand in those perfect cheekbones. Then, back with the applesauce cake, she'd pause by his chair, a hint of spice about her.
That's Patricia Gray. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and it was a book we're talking about that's brand new, entitled Rupture. What's the name of that poem?
Blessing.
Do you know what I love about that poem?
What's that?
It's sexy.
It is?
It's sexy. I mean, here is this woman. What is her power? This man is sweating. He comes in from the fields, we might imagine. He is in a coat to sit down to dinner in a country kitchen that might be in the, what, 1800s?
Yes, at least. It was way back.
And why is he so obedient? You don't give us any hints in the poem until she leans over him, and there's that wonderful line, a touch of spice. What is that line exactly?
A touch of spice about her. It's the applesauce cake.
Right. But it's also the attraction between them. Mm-hmm. And so I loved that poem when I read it. And I wondered how you knew about that.
Family stories. At family reunions, my family just tells stories.
Because you're from the South.
I guess so.
And that's what people do.
And I'm always eager to hear them.
She's from near Charlottesville, Virginia. And she received her MFA from the University of Virginia. And this is what Billy Collins, former poet laureate of the United States, says about Patricia Gray. Passion, memory, fancy, desire, loss, all the notes of poetry are clearly audible in the poetry of Patricia Gray. To pick up this book is to hold the whole being of another. Let's hear another poem.
This is called Calf Born in Snow, and it is the poem that was picked up by Garrison Keillor immediately when this book came out. It begins, I can still hear the loud moan in my grandfather's kitchen, where the wood stove was open for the failing fire's warmth, and on the oven door, wrapped in an old quilt, lay the new Charolais calf. A twin that survived its snowy birth that morning, though its brother died. Both of them the color of muddy snow, this one too weak to stand. We tried to feed him his mother's milk, but he seemed to forget he was eating and slept. So that by 10 that night, when he raised his head suddenly, making a loud meh sound, I could scarcely believe it. He's getting better. Dad put his hand on my shoulder. Quiet. He's dying, was all he said. Old knowledge, deep as the blue mountains. Still, I'd witnessed that final wonderful rallying. As if every ounce of life pulled together to raise the calf's head, to leave his sound so indelibly there.
That's the voice of Pat Gray. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. As I read your book, Patricia, I say to myself, poetry is a journey. It is a journey. Each book is a journey. If yours is, what is it a journey through? What do you suppose?
Well, it's a journey through time, and it's a journey through events that lead to some kind of insight or honesty about my life.
Mm. And that direct experience has to be confronted and changed.
Right, uh-huh. We have these moments, I think, when it's possible to change. We get lifted out of the ordinary for a moment, and it's possible to see something we haven't seen and to take some action one way or another.
I like that idea of taking action, because the poet then is someone who is not helpless.
Right, uh-huh.
We can change our experience no matter what happens, because we have that wonderful ability to create legend, maybe. The truth would be too bare, right?
Often it is, but one thing I've learned about writing poetry is to go for an emotional truth, even though the facts of the situation may change to fit the poem, the art form you're making, but keep the emotional truth.
Oh, that's excellent. Let's hear some more emotional truth from Patricia Gray.
Okay, this poem is called Rich with Desire, and it's about that time that feels sort of naughty when you go back to your parents' house with your husband, your new husband, or your lover, and you end up sleeping together in the bed that you slept in when you were a child. Rich with desire. We wake in the room I grew up in. Birds chirping summer outside. The child of our bodies, thrumming his delight, kicking small feet, waving flexed arms like wings. In the crib that was mine, just as this bed was mine, and still holds the shape of my girlish body, before the fevered intrusions of love. Hold me then, husband, in this protected place, rich with lust, as we turn and turn in the covers, trespassing through time.
A universal experience that no one has written about until now. And then, Patricia, what happens when your children come back with their husbands? You want to put them in double beds.
I know. I don't want to be there.
Patricia Gray taking us through the journey of her life, which brings up the question, how much do we say? How much do we put in a poem? William Matthews says everything. He says put everything in, and I think he means emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point is the censor there, or should the censor be there? Now, in that poem, there was a moment of intimacy which takes courage. Was that something you had to overcome?
It was, to some extent, to own up to what happened, you know, to first be aware of it, you know, and then to think about lying in that bed where I had lain as a child, you know, and here, and to have my now husband there with me. It was extraordinary. And also, there's a hint of naughtiness. You know, I was partially still that little girl.
Of course. In the same room.
Mm-hmm.
Did it have the same wallpaper?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
You know, David Gawanter says that there's, within a poem, another poem. So perhaps the naughtiness in your poem is the kind of the center of it that we don't get on the first reading.
Right. I think that's right.
And I do think that's true about your poems. They stand up for several reading, as delicate as they are. They have levels, mm-hmm, and veils, which are very, very skillfully put down. I bet you threw away 500 poems to make up this book.
Well, you know, this one came easily, but some of them I do.
Mm-hmm. We're at the Library of Congress, and that's Pat Gray, and she's going on.
The next poem is Miss Western Auto. And in this one, I try to find part of the discomfort I felt as a teenage girl, about 14, being in a beauty contest. So I do want to tell you about a camera that plays a part in this poem. It's a Revere camera, and it takes two exactly the same pictures. And those pictures are then mounted on a slide, and you can look at them through a 3D viewer. Turn the light on, and you can see a three-dimensional picture of yourself. So my uncle had one of these. The past jumps forward from inside the lit viewer when Dan shows me the 3D photo of Ellie and me in strapless gowns standing beside the fir tree in Grandmother's yard waiting for the field day parade. Our creamy shoulders and bright looks startle me. Dan says he could almost step into that picture, taken with my uncle's Revere camera, and walk between those girls frozen in time on the third Saturday in August as they wait for the float to carry them away. The white clapboard house is the same. Even the light in the yard is the right golden hue for boarding the float with my friend. As we ride into town, wave, throw candy to children, I am learning the power of beauty. At the temporary stage, guards from the junior order offer their arms, present us with blue-tinted carnations, which we pin on, and numbers we carry before us like fans. My uncles, so safe and protective, slip into the crowd, joining men who look us up and down like items at auction requiring a bid. What happened to my uncles? They've changed. A small voice in me cries as the program begins. Rivulets of sweat run down my temples and cleavage. Miss Western Auto, my banner says. And though it scratches, I like it, for it means I'm one of the chosen. Called back before the judges, I try to guess what they see. The winner is named, and suddenly, the special attention is all gone. I become an awkward girl, whose hair is too short and straight, whose legs are too long. Dan complains, we'll be late, so I put down the past, to dress in red with strappy sandals and pumps. Glittering earrings, today's look. Still, the aura of that day returns when a man jumps up and holds my chair. I wonder at the pageantry of it, the distance between men and women, the distance between viewer and viewed, the binocular nature of vision that allows our two eyes to see separately, but blend completely for depth.
Pat Gray, known as Patricia Gray, author of Rupture. Everybody thinks it's going to be Rapture. Don't they say that to you?
Yes, they do.
And they say, oh, I think somebody misspelled the title of that book. But there is a poem which makes it very clear about Rupture. And harking back to that poem we just heard, Miss Western Auto. Were all the girls competing to be Miss Western Auto?
No.
Each one had a different banner, sponsored
by a little business in town.
And
so
Miss Western Auto did not win, but what did win? Do you remember?
I don't remember which, but the girl was not from our county.
Oh, darn. I hate it when those outlanders come in and take our banners. But that is just such a wonderful poem. Just for the sake of craft, I always said, I can tell a lot by the way a poet begins a poem. So how you began the story was not, I remember, but you start with a camera.
Right.
You start with vision. And you carry that and complete it at the end of the poem with something about a view.
The binocular nature of vision.
Yes, that's right. And so we start the poem a certain way with a dimension of experience, and we end with that unity, which I think is very, very well done.
It took a long time to find the ending for the poem.
I can believe that, because you really needed to lift it away from an anecdote. You just couldn't have, this is what happened, and this is the way it felt. So you really created another depth to it. I admire that poem very much.
Thanks.
I'm sorry you didn't win, Pat. I'll get you a banner. Really? What do you want to be? Miss what?
Well, I don't think I want to be in a beauty contest anymore.
But just think how many of us never got to a beauty contest. So that was really a Southern story. Patricia Gray is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And we're finding out what makes her tick, but more importantly, what makes her poems tick? And they're really a little more complicated than they hear. They're so easy on the ear that we love to probe and go into them. Let's have another.
Okay. This one is in three parts. It's called Secrets at My Uncle's House. Part one. I learn from you the elegance of proof, complex math, and my own inadequacies. That imagination steals energy from the real world, and even memory, so tidy and selective, can be brutal in its sameness, from which the density of touch is vanished, from which completion is barred, as it is for the buck leaping at the fence, or the puzzle always being worked on your table. I have come here, Uncle, for my sanity, that it might stabilize like an object in your room, like the fox skull you found in a field and baked till the spiders ran out. If there is any wisdom, it must be in collections such as these, in the clutter of your nests and shells, in the gargoyle or geode that waits to be taken up and turned in the hand, as if some lesson were in it, a clue to the unfocused excitement it provokes. Or wisdom might grow from movement, from the circular sweep of your arm as you lean over the conch shell puzzle, searching for the shapes you must have, while I rest my cheek on the smooth leather chair that sits on the worn rug slightly off square, and gaze at the objects everywhere on ledges, mock-ups, old prints, open books. It is evening, and the curtains are open. At the window, your telescope slants toward the North Star, as if this house were a navigable craft, and you were to take her home.
Pat Gray, the reason why I love to listen to you read is because you literally visualize your imagery as you're saying it. You are not reading the words. You are looking at that fox's skull. And you, because of that, we absolutely can enter your consciousness. It's a mechanical quantum physics thing. That when you image and you make a hologram of your thinking, by the way you tell the story, we can go in there. I mean, have you ever read a book to a kid and don't really read it? You just read the words a bit. They don't listen because you're not really creating the experience. So I love to hear you.
Well, as you know, poets need to read that way, I think. I've told poetry students to stand behind their poems, but what I mean by that is to be in them while you're reading.
And it's wonderful because that takes our ego out of it, and we can almost forget we're nervous because we are. It's the material that matters so much, and you make that matter. Patricia Gray is on her way. She is going cross-country now to read in many a nook and cranny, and she will be featured at the Southern Women Writers Conference in Georgia. She will be part of a presentation on autobiographical engagements with family history, and she will go all through the South talking to fiction and poetry classes at schools, bookstores, and on TV and radio. I didn't know the poetry was in demand.
I didn't either, but the state poetry societies are absolutely wonderful, and they are happy to have visitors come, and they'll set up readings. And one of the places I'm going, of course, is to a school where I'll teach fiction and writing to high school students.
And I need to read your fiction next, because I know that's a skill you have.
I do have, but I haven't written much lately.
Well, we teach it then.
We can still teach it.
Pat Gray, I'm Grace Cavalieri with the Library of Congress. But it would be fine if we could, on some occasion, maybe at the Writer Center or some panel, have you speak to the network of poetry throughout the country, because I think poets have no knowledge of this. And it would be a great service for you to say, look what you can do. And I'm sure the state societies would be really grateful for that help. So let's talk about that later. We'll do something about that. You know, Grace Cavalieri, Pat Gray, together.
This poem is called Late in the Day. And in it is mentioned an Arrowby, which is very much like a Frisbee, but it doesn't have a center. So it's really a plastic donut that you throw. It's about a holiday with one's family, with my family. We continue our grievances at dinner. The short one is teased, the thin one maligned, rivalries rekindled, grown children disowned. The holiday meal nearly ended. We abandoned turkey bone and gristle, cranberry sauce sweet and bitter as blood, and surrender one by one to the children, urging us out to play Araby. My ex-husband and son have gone to new families. Only my brother, sister, and children and the sturdy man I now love stand with me in the lengthening light to toss the plastic ring that rises as if to go over the sun, though it glides up in a slow loop only, and down, passing from hand to hand. The brother who has tormented me tosses carefully now, so that I will catch and throw to the child between us, or to my sister, who with her great bulk hoards all that she has lost, yet lumbers to catch the ring, as the circle widens like a ripple, or shrinks to hold something we've never known, how to be together without rancor, as if life could be just this easy, and the family we are given by birth or by choice is the right one for us, the only one, and this life, this one life, is enough.
If you were teaching that poem, how would you teach people to tell their story and use some sort of unifying principle? Would you use that game you were playing as an example? Is that something you feel is a good template?
That's what started the poem, because it was a precious moment, or several precious moments, in the late afternoon sun after a big family dinner. And I wanted to somehow capture it, to let people know it wasn't just going out to play Araby with your relatives. I mean, there was a lot more than that. It was a much deeper occurrence for us. I'm not sure the rest of the folks felt that way, but I sure did.
I think you were the poet in the crowd. Anyway,
it's true.
There was a lot of resolutions happening during that moment.
Mm-hmm.
A lot came together. The person who was teased was actually catered to for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And as always, the language you use furthers the notion. I mean, harking back to Miss Western Auto, when you put words together like juxtaposition of, we went to the float carrying us away. Just think of that. Carrying, float, carries, floats.
Mm-hmm.
So you often do that, and I think it's unconscious. In your uncle's house, the buck leaping. you always follow a word which is a further extension of that word. It's very interesting to me. And in this case, the cranberry sauce, bitter as blood, we get the tenor of what's really going on underneath the poem, which is a little bit of rancor.
There's always that there.
Thanksgivings are well known for that.
You have a great Thanksgiving poem that I admire.
Thank you. We get to the end of the poem, and for a moment we are at peace. That moment after dinner where people have come together, you've finished the tasks, and you achieve a tremendous amount of serenity. Will you read the last line again for us, please? The last two lines, I guess, actually.
This family we're given is the right one, the only one, and this life, this one life, is enough.
This is the voice of Patricia Gray. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.